DuPont is a great company, but they don't, they're not noted for speed. And so things moved fairly slowly. And because we would ask for information, it would be weeks before we'd get it back, and then it wouldn't be quite what we wanted, we'd ask again. But this thing started probably in September or October.
Correct.
Of 82, and in June of 83, DuPont said, well, we had to make an offer. We made an offer at the time, and after a little fiddling around, they accepted it. And we offered $600 million for the business, subject to adjustments in inventory and all sorts of things like that. And we spent the next, but this was all verbal, and we spent 3 months writing a fairly simple letter of intent. Again, mainly because of the slow reaction. I mean, so we signed a letter of intent about October of 83, and up to that time they hadn't let us talk to the management. So at this point they let us talk to the management, and we had a major problem in that there were all sorts of ties between the Lake Charles refinery and the Lake Charles petrochemical complex. They used joint barge loading facilities. The steam systems were intertwined. The power systems were intertwined. We took kerosene from the refinery. We extracted the straight chain hydrocarbons. We sent the raffinate back to the refinery. And there were over 30 contracts that had to be worked out. And I decided the thing to do is to let the management work this out. So the morning of the 1st of November, I was jogging up on the roof, and I felt some sharp pains in my gut. And I'd slow down and go away. I'd speed up, and I knew pretty well what was there. Well, 2 days later, I was having open heart surgery. Mm. And when I started recovering, I'd be checking on the phone to see what was going on, and it was obvious nothing was going on. The management and the refinery people couldn't get along, and they couldn't settle anything because they'd been fighting with each other over this sort of thing for a long time. It was the first time the refinery people had the ability to be difficult. And our people, the management probably was difficult. And so the first time I was able to travel was right after Christmas, and we went to Wilmington, and DuPont said, if you don't get this all settled within 30 days, we're going to pull out. And I made a deal with them for them to assign some senior people to negotiate, because we've been dealing with two low-level people, and this part of it got moved along. And a month later, we hadn't finished, but we'd gone so far that, and I got back in it myself, we'd gone so far that they were happy. And then we started having problems in another area. We had gotten banks to agree to put up part of the money. We'd gotten the Prudential Insurance Company and a group of insurance companies to put up the subordinated debt. And everything seemed to be moving along very well. And sometime about February or March, the Federal Reserve wrote a letter to all banks saying, we want to report on the high leverage transactions you're engaged in. And some banks disregarded it as a request for information. Others decided the sky is falling and we have to run for cover. And we had two banks that were our lead banks, Manufacturers Hanover and Bankers Trust. And Bankers Trust just decided the sky was falling and announced they were pulling out of, Good Friday morning, DuPont, in the course of this, would every 2 or 3 weeks would check with Prudential and the banks to see if everything was in order. Good Friday morning, they called the banks and everybody was in order. That afternoon, Bankers Trust called and said they were pulling out of the deal, which just everything folded up. And so we would have been dead in the water and the thing would have fallen apart, except that this had gone on so long that DuPont decided, not because they wanted to make this deal, but because they didn't want to waste all this time and do nothing, that they'd give us some help. So they put out word among the banks that DuPont wanted this thing to go through. And they signed a piece of paper that said guarantee at the top, and DuPont signed at the bottom, and their lawyers wrote in between practically nothing. It guaranteed some of our debt to a limited extent under some unusual circumstances, but the only thing that happened was that DuPont had indicated to the financial community they wanted this to go, and so our bankers went back together, and from then on it was just a matter of putting together the legal things, and we got it closed in July, and that started Vista Chemical. And then along the way, before that, I decided that doing deals like this was more fun than running a chemical company. And a young man that I'd run across before, who was bright and able and had been doing mergers and acquisitions for a local firm, asked me to, his firm went out of business, or rather the principal had a heart attack and had to give up the business, and so he asked me to sort of help him take it over, and I did, and he has done sort of LBOs separate from me, but I mean sort of under my wing, but in smaller things. Then sometime, I guess in the fall of 85, while I was chairman of the board of Vista, I heard that the Texas City plant was for sale. Called Monsanto and found it was for sale. They were already talking to dozens of people about buying it, to Amoco, to Standard Bohau, and I got involved in it, got all the data, made an offer. Well, by this time, I'd sort of outgrown Hutton, and they were having trouble internally. The people that I'd worked with had moved on to other things, so I went forward on my own and found it raising money like this wasn't a big job. And the key to doing the Texas City deal was that we made acetic acid, acrylonitrile, styrene, plasticizers, and a few odds and ends. And we needed some sort of contract to give us some support, and nobody wants to sign a styrene or a acrylonitrile contract. But the idea occurred that BP was big in acetic acid everywhere but in the United States, and they might want to get in the acetic acid business. And so we approached them and very quickly made a deal under which they underwrote a lot of the financing in return for us effectively turning the acetic acid business over to them, or really doing a very elaborate toll processing deal with them. So that let us finance Sterling Chemical.
I've read somewhere that, in these LBOs, and that's certainly in the period you're talking about, that was certainly a lot of activity.
Yeah.
In all areas, but yours, the Vista was the first one in the chemical industry. But part of an LBO, as I understand it, is that you end up selling off part of the assets, and you didn't do that.
I didn't do that, and that's not a necessary part of it. A lot of people did that, but it wasn't my style. And the other thing we consistently did was not cut anybody's wages, not cut benefits. We commit right up front that we're going to maintain the same wages and benefits. Now, I've been lucky in some regards, and that is that except the Vista, all of the subsequent things I did, the seller did didn't want to sell anything but the assets, and did not want to turn loose any staff except plant managers and below. So I did not have any requirement to take upper level staff, which made things very easy, because we've consistently run with about a third or a fourth the overhead the predecessors ran with, and run better. And so Sterling Chemical, that plant had not made any money for a number of years, and if we hadn't made the BP contract, we would never have financed it. But with the BP contract, we were able to finance it. And the styrene business turned around within 2 or 3 months after we closed the deal, and the prices went up, and paid off all the debt within 87. 2 years later, we were out of debt, and declared a big dividend, and then went public, which was a mistake. We should not, this is too cyclic a business to be a public company. We should never have gone public, and that was one of the mistakes that I think was made. But one of the things I've done consistently in this is to insist that all the key people buy stock. We put in stock option plans, but in addition, I wanted them to be at risk. I wanted to have not just a win-win situation, but one where if things went bad, they had to buckle down and help. And we put in ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans. And I would say in the four deals very successful deals that I've done, every key man, and by this I mean people earning from 60,000 up, is now a millionaire. They've made over $1 million. The employees can have from out of their ESOP from 3 to 4 to 5 times annual salary in the ESOP. We'll have that when they leave, when they retire. So, but about a year after the Sterling Chemical, which is a Texas City deal, I had known that there was a plant, an ethylene plant down in Corpus Christi, and I'd known, you know, the chemical business is a gossipy business, and everybody knows pretty much what's going on. And everybody knew that the owners, Solvay, Union Pacific, and ICI, were not happy with it. And they even hired a guy named Jack St. Clair, who was a former president of Shell Chemical, to sell it for them, although they would never admit they were selling it. And I would talk to Jack, and they had financed it with all totally borrowed money, but was guaranteed by their parents. And they were not making enough money to pay off the loan, so the owners were paying off the loan, and they were determined not to sell it for less than the unpaid loan. It wasn't worth that. And I probably talked to Jack first about this around 82 or 3. And about once a year I checked with him, and the loan had gone down, but the value of the plant still wasn't up. And so about 86, the value of the loan had gone down to the point I thought it was probably worth it. And set out to buy it. And started negotiating with them, and on all these things you try not to get too far ahead of whoever's going to supply the money. So I talked to Chase, who I thought would finance it, and they said, well, it's very, maybe you can convince us that the ethylene business is going to turn around, because at that point it was losing money and had for years, but we won't finance a one plant, one product operation. Go find something else. And so I started looking around, called DuPont about half of a glycol plant they own, and they said, well, it's for sale, but we're much more interested in talking to you about 3 polyethylene plants and an ethylene plant. And so I started talking to DuPont about that, start talking to PPG about the other half of the line call plant, to ICI about their line call plant. And the only one I was failed on was that I could buy all of the polyethylene ethylene thing, but I never was successful in buying the DuPont half the glycol plant, because it was in a different group at DuPont, and they just were not, well, I don't know, I couldn't make a deal with them. But anyway, we wound up putting together 7 ethylene related plants into something called Kane Chemical. And we did it just as the ethylene business was turning around. This first month this Corpus Christi plant ever made money was the month we bought it. It's just blind luck. Now, it wasn't. Along the way, I had to convince banks, though, that this was going to happen.
This early test that you said earlier before that said you would be a good salesman must be pretty accurate then, because of your ability to do just what you've said.
The main selling was to sell people and putting up the money. And Kane Chemical just took off like a rocket. And of the 5 key people, we didn't take any overhead people. We took a few low-level overhead people, but Bill McMinn, who had been at FMC, was the president. We got a man from Carbide to run the, John Lutzinger, to run the polyethylene business. A man that I'd worked with at Petrotex to run the hydrocarbon part of the business. We persuaded an ARCO, a fairly high ARCO treasurer, to leave ARCO and join us as financial officer. And somehow I got started here in Sterling Chemical hiring. When we put Sterling Chemical together, there was a young, bright young lawyer, very successful in one of the law firms here. They didn't work on my deal, but just wanted to leave the law and go into business. So he left and joined Sterling Chemical and did and sort of the chief counsel and vice president of everything that nobody else is doing. I did the same thing at Kane Chemical, the same thing at Fiber Industries, and so I staffed these people from outside, but mostly people I had some tie to and knew something about. And almost exactly this time, and I'll tell you the reason, we were wondering, Kane Chemical was just doing so well, we started to think about going public. And we're beginning, we've got studies of what it's worth if you go public. And the Nalco company has had for a long time a quail hunt every year, which they invite people from the chemical industry, and I have gone for a number of years, and I'm going this Thursday, and then on a comparable Thursday in '88 I went on it, and one of the people there was a man named Dale Lawrence of Occidental, and he told me Occidental wanted to buy this and offered $800 million for it. And I laughed at him, went away, and about 6 weeks later, they called back and offered us $1.2 million for the equity. And after a very short discussion, we made a deal and closed it 5 weeks later, which was transferred the money 5 weeks later, which is almost a record in this sort of thing. We sold this company that we'd started, the equity that we put $27 million in, we sold it for $1.2 million, which in less than a year, which just can't be anything but.
In that short period of time, see how I can phrase this. You were able to acquire these companies because the big companies were getting out of commodities and looking for specialties.
They wanted to upgrade them.
looking for a faster profit. So all of a sudden these became available, then the market turned around after you had acquired them. But what was it that Occidental saw that made them go to make an offer of that well, magnitude?
Since since these are fairly bright people, I think they first were confident they could pay for it before the boom was over. Mm-hmm. Second, that you know, it sort of fit in their whole overall scheme of things. And Occidental has never been like some of the other. It has been a commodity operation pretty much. You know, whether it's hog carcasses or oil, or even in the oil business, they haven't done much upgrading. And so it fit in the Occidental pattern, and they, as I say, were confident the boom would last long enough that they'd get their money back, and so they did. And so it worked very well. They're happy with the deal.
One of the things also that I've noticed is that you have, I don't know if you've insisted, but it's certainly you have involved employee ownership.
I have.
And for a number of reasons, one of which gives you a more dedicated employee and more efficiency in your operation. But I also read that when you sold Kane Chemical, you personally weren't convinced, but it was your the welfare of your employees and their benefit from that sale.
I think that's essentially true, because see, at that point I had enough money that money was not much factor anymore. Here's something that I'd put together. I was running it differently from other people, the way other people run, and it was a great temptation to see if if this thing would really go forward. But here I had, sitting around the table with me, were these Bill McMahon, John Lutzinger, all who essentially had most everything they had in this thing. And it just, I just couldn't bring myself to put them at risk by insisting that they not cash in at this point. And so that, you know, I would love to have kept it, but it just didn't make any sense to me to keep them from cashing in.
I had a couple notes here. We've mentioned a few of these things, but I let's see if I can find the right page. A number of reasons why your LBOs were successful. We've talked about employee ownership. We've talked about not having upper level management that you had to bring along that gave you more flexibility, and you could cut off some of those layers. Supply contracts with major companies, so you didn't have to have a big sales force.
Yeah. Well, you know, DuPont, when we took over the polyethylene business, had a 30-man sales force. We had a 3-man sales force, because we just decided in the beginning that there are a lot of these small accounts that just are not worth fooling with. And we've done the same thing in Sterling Chemical. We have a lot of what you'd call processing agreements. That if Phillips, for example, wants styrene, we'll take their benzene and ethylene, and we're doing that to make styrene for Monsanto. Probably a third of our styrene business is on processing contracts, and this has several advantages. You don't need a lot of salesmen, but the other big one is you don't have any working capital tied up. And when in this sort of thing, you get very conscious of money and capital, and some of the things we've done consistently is we operate consistently at much lower inventories than any of our predecessors did, which means we use that money to pay off debt. We've consistently run with fewer rail cars than they used. One of the things that happened, and again, this is an accident, when we bought Vista, one of the first things that happened was that Ford Motor Company said, in order to sell to us, you have to have a statistical process control program. And I thought that's a lot of crap because we never had a quality problem. But if you had to do that, you had to do it. So we looked around, and I discovered for the first time for Dr. Deming. I don't know if you've run across Deming at all or not. But and we got one of his disciples to come in and give courses, and I got pretty sold on the whole thing. And as a result of that, we made major improvements in our operations. As I say, we're consistently using about 20-cent fuel tank, fuel rail cars than our predecessors used. We're running at much lower inventories than they did. We operate with less working capital. I think we probably, just across the board, have a more effective operation, mainly because this is employee involvement. Because part of the Deming philosophy is that when you start trying to direct something, you don't invite the engineering department. You ask the people who are doing it how to do it better. And so we run very good operations.
Yes, I think I've read that you could reduce overhead by 70-80% sometimes.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. This isn't too accurate, but Monsanto was charging $27 million overhead to the Texas City plant, and it was all mixed up with other departments. When we took it over, we were running with $7 million overhead. So that's the Kane Chemical. We had a total overhead, including R&D, and we had a fair amount of R&D, of 2%. Now, a DuPont will have an overhead of 15%. Now, these are big numbers. Not only that, you run better. You have fewer levels of management. You have better communication. If everybody is busy, nobody has time to worry about protecting his turf and all that sort of thing. And one of the results of these team efforts to make improvements in the Deming system is that people start talking to each other across departments and across levels of management, and you get away from a lot of the things that you had before.
I imagine you get decisions made much more rapidly, and people feel more freer to make a decision without having to explain it to someone.
Yeah,
else.
That's right. Yeah, and so. No, it's made a difference.
Was there life after Kane Chemical? I mean, that must have been a whirlwind years for you.
Well, the next thing is Celanese merged with Hoechst. And they were, as part of the deal, they had to divest their polyester fiber business. And they decided... Well, Hoechst was sort of calling the shots, and they decided to divest the Celanese business rather than the Hoechst business, and they put it out, and we bid on it and were the successful bidder. And then we got into a long 6-month hassle with the FTC because they wanted Celanese to divest different things than Celanese wanted to divest. And not only that, they wanted to divest the wrong thing. Even from the FTC point of view, they were wrong. And we wouldn't have bought what the FTC wanted them to divest because they wanted to divest the poorest plants. They didn't know that, but that's what they were, what they were trying to do. So we went into a 6-month discussion, finally got them to approve it, put this together, ran it for a couple of years, did the same things here, and sold it to the Wellman Company after about 2 years. And the equity owners got in the 32 or 33 times what they put in it. And the employees wound up with about twice their annual salary in the ESOP.